So I'm going to pull out a few things from research that I recently conducted in the North End and the African Nova Scotian community in the North End, but I also wanted to contextualize this discussion by making connections between race, space, white privilege, and power as they pertain to gentrification in the North End. There are a few questions that I think are important to pose. First, what is the importance of neighborhood identity, community cohesiveness, neighborhood bonds, and sense of place for African Nova Scotians experiencing gentrification in the North End? And I'm pulling from Shireen Razak's book entitled Race, Space, and the Law, where she used a spatial theory to discuss the symbolic and material constitution of actual spaces and the relationship between identity, race, and space, posing several questions. First, what is being imagined or projected onto specific spaces and bodies? How much does an identity of dominance rely upon keeping racial others firmly in place? How are people kept in their place? How does place become race? The spatial approach offers the possibility of examining the simultaneous operation of multiple systems of domination, including race, class, and gender. Gentrification, like other systems of domination, such as employment and labor and environmental racism, is a racialization process that is directly experienced as spatial by those who feel displaced, as well as those who are newcomers to a neighborhood, because it reaffirms existing racial hierarchies and consequently helps to sustain the social order. Entitlement to space, in this case the North End, which is the space we're discussing today, is a sign of personhood and legitimacy and is enacted both by those who feel displaced and those who are new to that space. Therefore, we need to denaturalize geographical spaces through critical interrogation of the role of law in producing and sustaining racial hierarchies of our white settler society. So one example is, of course, Africville, which was discussed. The eviction of one of Nova Scotia's oldest black communities from Africville is an example of how municipal land use regulations enabled white people to successfully dismantle a black community. So in research I recently conducted in the North End on African Nova Scotians that was completed early this year, I wanted to get a sense from African Nova Scotians about the sense of loss, the sentiments they had about the sense of loss that they defined symbolically and materially with respect to gentrification. And I just wanted to pull out a few quotes. One quote was already indicated by Ted, but a few quotes in terms of this sense of entitlement that African Nova Scotians feel to their place and to their space, and a sense of loss that happens simultaneously. You can look down the street and see people sitting out on patios and some really nice restaurants in the community, but you don't see us. You see us in that one area around the square. You see the kids walking back and forth to school. But it's almost like we don't own this community anymore, and other people are claiming it as their own. I'm in spaces where there aren't a lot of black people, and what I'm hearing up at Fred's place, up on the corner, and at Edna's, and at these other places, is our community, our community. I don't see one person in that room that looks anything like me. They're not from the community. They're claiming this community. We need to claim it too. According to another participant, housing is the main mechanism by which the pushing out of African Nova Scotians is enabled. It's not affordable. They're staying with the market rent. That's what they tell me. There's no non-profit housing. It's no longer nonprofit. I think they're bringing all these condos and stuff in because they're really trying to push us out of this neighborhood. Like, we'll put this here, but they can't afford it. They won't be able to afford it. Other participants discussed the loss of various resources that were mainstays in the community. I don't like the fact that they're putting all these businesses, all these condos here. What happened to everything we used to have? Like, we lost our grocery store, our little place where we could go shopping, like our bank, like everything we had on the street is gone. We literally have to travel to get somewhere. As a community, we should have been able to keep that. So I also wanted to get a sense from the community members about their suggestions for how they can flourish in the North End amidst ongoing gentrification. And there was we wanted to kind of get a sense from them what their vision factors were. Vision factors are what you consider to be requirements for a healthy community. And because I work with a social determinants of health approach, it's not simply about illness and disease, but what is required in a particular community for health and well-being. And health and well-being is a broader term than health because it's not necessarily about disease, but about what keeps a particular community healthy. We know transportation does, access to recreation, access to green space, access to employment, access to kind of symbolic ideologies about what makes you feel as if you belong to a particular neighborhood. So in asking community members about their vision of a healthy community, in a sense, I'm asking them about their recommendations about gentrification, how we can address some of the issues that go alongside gentrification that could help support the community to flourish amidst gentrification. And of course, the big one was housing and home ownership. They discussed increased home ownership in the African Nova Scotian community, decent and safe and affordable housing that spreads across the region, stabilizing existing renters, which could include assessing displacement rates, creating rent stabilization policies such as eviction controls and rent increase schedules, developing limited equity housing cooperatives and other forms of resident-controlled housing, which allows a neighborhood to stabilize by turning some of the high proportion of renters into homeowners. That's in housing. In terms of representation within the economic structure of the North End, they discussed more business opportunities, business ownership opportunities for African Nova Scotians, increased employment of African Nova Scotians in businesses and agencies in the area, including those of low income and those who reside in public housing, increased hiring of African Nova Scotians on the police force because of harassment, ongoing harassment in the community. When they discussed services and programs, they discussed asset mapping in the community to collect data on existing resources and services in order to determine which services are missing and which services are needed. More immediate services in the community, including food delivery services, affordable and subsidized ambulance services, taxi services, banks, bank machines, laundromats, grocery stores, health services, access to doctors within the community and dental clinics. More recreational programs, including programs for youth. We also discussed social interaction, creating a community-centered environment where all citizens can live, work, and coexist together. Create more opportunities for community members to interact through the incorporation of transportation links, such as bike paths, and developing public spaces that attract all. Creating opportunities for both those against gentrification and those who are for gentrification to come into social dialogue, just as we're doing today, so more of this, to hear different opinions, concerns, and needs related to gentrification. With respect to community capacity building and organizing, they discuss bringing together actors in community development, neighborhood associations, and urban planning to develop a proposal for a broad policy response to displacement in the community, creating sustained investment from the public sector and foundations to build local capacity to achieve equitable development, which may include engaging in locally relevant research. I've done that. It'd be great to use that. Using data and information to support policy change and inform campaigns. Crafting a campaign strategy. There was also a broad discussion on race, racism, and white ignorance. So just taking from Ted Rutland's discussion on white ignorance, I wanted to talk specifically about white privilege and racism and anti-racism. So it's really important to acknowledge the role that race plays in the process of community revitalization, but also to acknowledge that race is experienced as a complex interplay of race, class, and culture. That means that all of us, but particularly white individuals, need to confront the racial hierarchies that structure our lives in various spaces. You also have to challenge the notion of law as raceless, as well as the amnesia that enables white subjects to be produced as entitled, rational, legitimate, innocent, and ignorant. Recognizing white ignorance as a symptom of white privilege is about understanding gentrification and other processes of racialization in general, including environmental racism, discrimination in employment, discrimination in the labor market, and everyday forms of discrimination. Central to this is an understanding of anti-racism, using an anti-racism lens to understand and articulate the symbolic and material realities of whiteness. Anti-racism is important to this discussion because it not only argues for the saliency of race for people of color, but it acknowledges that one cannot fully understand the social effects of race without appreciating how race intersects with other forms of difference, such as socioeconomic status, social class, poverty, gender identity, sexual orientation, and other social factors. Anti-racism examines the ways that racist policies and actions are manifested, entrenched, and unconsciously supported by institutional structures to consciously or unconsciously promote and sustain differential advantage or privilege for certain racial groups. It interrogates historically constituted relations of domination and subordination by questioning white male power and privilege. Just to give some context to anti-race to white privilege, it's about advantage, opportunity, benefit, a head start, or general protection from negative social mistreatment, which persons deemed white will typically enjoy, but with which others will generally not enjoy. And these benefits can be material, social, or psychological. In terms of material, it's recognizing that there are greater opportunities in the labor market, greater net worth due to history in which whites have had the ability to accumulate wealth to a greater extent than people of color. In terms of the social benefits of white privilege, it's about the presumptions of competence, credit worthiness, law abidingness, and intelligence. The psychological benefits of white privilege, not having to worry about triggering negative stereotypes, rarely having to feel out of place, and not having to worry about racial profiling. The material, social, and psychological benefits of white privilege have much to do with the fact that whiteness is a culturally normative space where white or Euro-Western identity, ideologies, ways of knowing, and institutions collude in ways that sustain white privilege, power, and dominance within agencies, businesses, and public spaces. Therefore, we need to continue to question the naturalizing and normativity of whiteness within public spaces and institutions in the North End amidst ongoing gentrification. It is only when we begin to particularize whiteness in discussions on the mechanisms and processes through which gentrification unfolds will we begin to understand gentrification as a highly raced, gendered, and classed phenomenon.